I'm an endocrinologist. I've focused on endocrine problems for the last 30 years or so. I do two things, actually. I'm the chief medical officer of a company that is developing approved therapies for type 2 diabetes, and I also am an associate professor at Stanford where I run one of the endocrine clinics, teach the house staff, and treat patients. What I want to do today is to go into more detail into diabetes. I know that you covered this kind of in an overview of endocrinology last week and 2 weeks ago. Of all the endocrine diseases, I'm not saying diabetes is necessarily the most interesting, but it is clearly the most important because it has reached, no question about it, epidemic proportions. This is from about now 4 years ago, but anyone who goes on the internet or reads the newspaper has seen multiple articles on the increasing prevalence of diabetes. Data that are reasonably current, about 21 million diabetics in the U.S. Prediction was that 10% of the U.S. population will have diabetes, 1 out of 10 people, by 2009. Let me say up front that Mr. Hammack is not going to test you on this information, so no reason to take notes. But do pay attention, because if there's any rhyme or reason to the AP biology test, if they ask you anything about endocrinology on the AP bio test, there might be a question or two about type 2 diabetes, because it is clearly the most important of the endocrine problems now. Probably even more scary than the fact that, well, this is the prediction, we're actually reaching this in 2009, ahead of schedule, that 1 out of 10 people in the U.S. have the disease. A much larger population, 5 times as many people, actually have what's called pre-diabetes, which is almost diabetes, which puts them at a very, very high risk over a period of a few years of developing diabetes. And in fact, 1 million of these patients a year switch over to becoming diabetic. So let's talk about first the dichotomy between type 1 and type 2 diabetes. I mean, both of these mean sweet year and diabetes mellitus. Both of them are characterized by an increase in the blood sugar. And when your blood sugar gets much above 200 mg per deciliter, your kidneys can't reabsorb it all, so you spill some in your urine, hence the sweet urine name. But there's really no good scientific rationale why they should be called pretty much the same thing. All they really much have in common is the fact that blood sugar is high. Other than that, they are completely different diseases. They have about as much in common as pneumonia, an infection of the lungs, and lung cancer, having a tumor in your lungs. Both are in the lungs, both can cause breathing problems, but they're two radically different diseases. These also are two radically different diseases. Type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune disorder. Okay? Used to be called juvenile onset diabetes. So back when I was an endocrine fellow in the 1980s, typically if somebody younger than about 20 was diagnosed with diabetes, from 6 months of age to the early 20s, 99% of the time it was type 1 diabetes. What happens is you're unfortunate enough to be born with the wrong genes, meaning the wrong immune response genes. So when you get one of the typical viral infections of childhood, pretty much a member of the Coxsackie virus, most of you have in fact had a Coxsackie infection, whether you know it or not, when you were kids, as part of your immune response to fight the virus, some of the antibodies you produce cross-react with epitopes on the beta islet cells, the insulin-producing cells of the pancreas. And in the course of wiping out the virus, you're also wiping out the islet cells that make insulin. So that's type 1 diabetes, autoimmune disorder, the beta islets, not the alpha cells that make glucagon, but the beta islets that make insulin are destroyed. So they present with very high blood sugar and no insulin. They need insulin to live. Those of you who read the article from the New York Times that Mr. Hammack sent around about those two brothers, I think have a good appreciation of the fact that anyone who was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes prior to 1923 died, and died fast, usually within about 6 months. Because only in 23 was there at least some ability to give people exogenous insulin. Not very effectively, but enough to keep people alive, and people like these brothers alive for a long time. So insulin required for survival. Type 2 diabetes, this is the epidemic form of the disease. This is the kind of diabetes that everybody is talking about. You know, the talking head on the news channel, etc., because this is causing huge problems. 10% of the world's population has this, and it's going up hugely year on year, causing a huge amount of problems, costing a huge amount of money, shortening lives. Autoimmune disease, inflammatory disease. Mechanism is different. Major cause here is a viral infection and having the wrong immune response to it. Major cause here is obesity, increase in fat, and specifically an increase in fat around the organs, visceral fat, fat where it doesn't belong, fat in the liver and fat in the muscle cells. That's what causes insulin resistance. So initially, whereas these patients present with high glucose and very low insulin, these patients present with high glucose and really high insulin, because their problem is not initially production of insulin, it's that the insulin doesn't work very well because their body is resistant to its effects. So as the glucose starts going up, the pancreas isn't stupid. It says, okay, blood sugar is higher, let's make more insulin. So it's pumping up more and more and more insulin. So they've got hyperglycemia, high blood glucose, with hyperinsulinemia, elevated insulin. Very, very different disease. However, what's causing the problem, the insulin resistance, again, is because you've got excess fat where it doesn't belong. This fat is releasing increased amounts of circulating free fatty acids, which are metabolized. A lot of the metabolites of the free fatty acids are inflammatory and toxic compounds. It also causes the immune cells, the macrophages, to go into this increased fat in your organs where it doesn't belong. Macrophages to secrete inflammatory cytokines, chemicals that normally go up in response to an infection, when you fight an infection, interleukin-1, interleukin-6, TNF-alpha. A combination of this increased efflux of free fatty acids and this increased production of inflammatory cytokines, this is what goes into all of the insulin-sensitive tissues, liver, muscle, fat, pancreas, beta islets, damages them and specifically causes the insulin resistance. Okay? Over time, because the islets now have been working overtime to make more and more insulin, and because they're getting the brunt of all these damaging chemicals that are coming in and damaging them, with time, the beta islets in a type 2 diabetic will peter out. So 30% of patients with type 2 diabetics, all of whom were started on diet, exercise, and oral drugs initially, at any point in time, 30% of them actually need insulin, because now they're no longer hyperinsulinemic, but they actually have low insulin. If a type 2 diabetic lives long enough with current therapy, all of them end up on insulin because the islets peter out. Two different diseases. Okay. Epidemiology covered already. Worldwide, about 250 million of people, about 6% of the world's population. This is going up hugely because, in fact, I'll show you how scary the increase in diabetes is in the U.S. It's even faster in places like India and China. 21 million in the U.S., I told you, a huge number with prediabetes. In the U.S., over this 10-year period, type 2 diabetes increased by, it almost doubled. Almost doubled over a 10-year period. Absolutely epidemic. By 2005, 11% of every dollar we spend for healthcare is being spent on treating diabetes. Back when I was an endocrine fellow, if you were 20 and you had diagnosed with diabetes, 99% chance it was type 1, autoimmune. Today, if an 11 or 12-year-old kid in middle school is diagnosed with diabetes, there's a better than 99% chance that it's actually type 2 diabetes because of obesity. Yeah?
Is the only way you can get type 2 diabetes is if you're overweight?
Really good question. No. 95, 98, 99% of the time it's related to obesity. But as with all diseases, there are some small populations. Two answers to that. First of all, in some populations, people of East Indian ancestry, people coming from India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, their deposition of fat is a little bit different. So at a lower body mass index, when they are leaner, they're putting more fat into their organs. Okay? And so somebody can meet our definition of lean, BMI of 21, 22, in that population and have insulin resistance and type 2 diabetes. So that's part of your answer. Another part of your answer, irrespective of your ancestry, is there are some families that have a beta islet defect in insulin release. Okay? And they can develop really type 2 diabetes at normal body weight. Okay? Also known as maturity onset diabetes of the young, MODY. But for the most part, you would be right far more often than you're wrong. If the question is asked on the AP biology test, what is the main cause of type 2 diabetes? And one of the choices is obesity. Pick obesity. Okay. It increases with age. By BMI increases with age. Visceral fat increases with age. We all gain weight as we get older. Tell surprise. Okay. So you can see that in a young population, first of all, these data are actually really scary to me because this is talking about percent of the entire population. But this is saying in a young population, when people are really at their peak health, more than 1 out of 100 people have type 2 diabetes. I mean, that pretty much defines a really, really, really common disease. 1 out of 100. Almost 2 out of 100 have it. But as you can see, as you get older, next decade of life, it goes up hugely by about fivefold. Next doubles in the next decade, doubles in the next decade. And impaired glucose tolerance, one form of prediabetes, also increases with age. So age is also a driver, very much confounded, though, by the increase in fat, increase in obesity, increase in visceral adiposity with age. Equally scary data, this is the increase in prevalence of type 2 diabetes in the U.S. from 1960, before any of you were born, to 2000. Over a 40-year period, it went from about maybe 0.75% of the population to now something approaching 29%, about a 3- to 4-fold increase in the prevalence, okay, of diabetes over that 40-year period. And the slope of this curve to epidemiologists is really, really scary because it shows no signs of leveling off. In fact, it's really going up hyperbolically. Okay. I lied a little bit. I said that there's really nothing that relates type 1 diabetes to type 2 diabetes besides high blood sugar. There's actually two things. Having high blood sugar, irrespective of the cause, whether you've wiped out your islets because of an autoimmune response or because you have it most commonly because of increased fat and insulin resistance, high blood sugar does bad things. Okay? Even at a normal blood sugar, some of the glucose in your blood is being non-enzymatically attached to proteins in your body. Okay? All proteins. And that can be measured, a very specific test, by looking how much sugar is stuck onto hemoglobin in your red cells. That's called the glycosylated hemoglobin, or hemoglobin A1C. Everybody in this room is probably normal. That means your hemoglobin A1C is less than 6%. Less than 6% of your hemoglobin has sugar on it. And probably the average person in this room has a hemoglobin A1C value of probably even less than 5%. 4.9, 4.8. Maybe the ones that are a little bit heavier are 5.2, 5.3. Okay? As the blood sugar gets high in diabetes, more and more of the sugar gets stuck onto your blood cells. Your HbA1c goes up, but more importantly, more and more sugar is stuck onto a bunch of other proteins in the body, non-enzymatically, and it damages everything it sticks to. It damages the eyes, causing retinopathy. It damages the kidneys, causing nephropathy. It damages the nerves, causing gastroparesis, where the stomach doesn't work properly. You eat, nothing goes out. You throw it up, then you have diarrhea, real problem, particularly patients on insulin. Okay? It damages the nerves here, so you have both painful neuropathy, so you can't sleep because you got burning, shooting pains in your feet at night. And also, in combination with pain, you've got numbness, so you can't feel when something is putting pressure on your skin, causing then ulcers, infection, and the leading cause of requiring amputations, the leading cause of causing blindness, the leading cause of causing kidney failure, as well as a lot of other complications. And this is common to both type 1 and type 2. High blood sugar, bad. This just shows you, again, the complications. We divide them into the small vessel complications, retinopathy, damaging the retina of the eye, damaging the kidney, damaging the nerves. High blood sugar increases the risk not only of retinal damage, which I'll show you a picture of, but also cataracts and glaucoma. A combination of all of these makes diabetes the number one cause of blindness among adults in the U.S. and the developed world. Africa, some parts of South America, a parasite causing river blindness is the number one cause of blindness. Okay, but in the developed world, it's diabetes. Nephropathy, the leading cause of end-stage kidney disease requiring dialysis, a very good thing to avoid. That is not fun to be on dialysis. And neuropathy, together with the macrovascular, peripheral vascular disease, closing off the arteries in the legs, these together are the leading cause of requiring people to lose their toes, their feet, their legs below the knee, their legs above the knee, because of infection. As bad as all of these complications are, which are the main complications that people, including physicians, think about as the long-term consequences of diabetes, it actually pales in significance compared to the huge increase in cardiovascular disease that comes along with sustained exposure to high blood sugar. Cardiovascular disease is already the number one killer of men and women. So if you had to flip a coin and say, how is anybody here in this room going to die eventually, you would be right more often than you're wrong if you had a heart attack or a stroke. Okay? Having diabetes increases that risk, as I'll show you, 2 to 5-fold. That's the number one killer of patients with diabetes as well. Okay. A lot of information here. I'll just point out that these complications, if you have diabetes, are not really rare events. Look at neuropathy. Lifetime risk, more than half of patients will have significant neuropathy. On an annual basis, 2 to 3% of patients with diabetes will develop foot ulcers, which often result to amputation. Really big problem. More than one-third of diabetics can look forward to developing end-stage renal disease, requiring either one of three choices, dialysis, a kidney transplant if you're lucky, or death. Okay? And all these things, cataracts you see increase by about a third. About 90% will develop retinopathy. About 9 out of 10 diabetics will develop eye damage, etc. Frozen shoulders, gastroparesis, bad stuff. A couple of pictures of why you lose your eyesight. This is a fundoscopic exam. This is the retina of the eye. There's the optic disc where the vessels come in. This is the lateral to that, the fovea centralis. This is where the greatest concentration of rods and cones are, where most of your acute vision takes place, in that area. And that's the area that usually gets neovascularization because of relative hypoxia, decreased oxygen getting there, and high IGF-1, insulin-like growth factor activity, high insulin levels. What you have is new tissues forming here. All this white stuff are these new, immature, bad blood vessels, which tend to be leaky, and so they tend to bleed. And how you, here you see the next stage where right in the area of the fovea where most of your vision takes place, there's been a pre-retinal hemorrhage. This patient has no central vision, okay? None at all. Again, just to make the point that even though what we think about with diabetes, what most patients with the disease think about, and what most physicians who take care of diabetics think about, are all these nasty complications like eye disease, 4% of all complications, kidney disease, 9% of all complications, neuropathy, 6%, everything else, frozen shoulder, cataracts, gastroparesis, autonomic dysfunction, you name it, 4%, and lose sight of the fact that 77% of all the complications resulting from type 2 diabetes are cardiovascular disease, heart attacks and strokes, which also carry the greatest mortality. And this slide makes a couple of points. These are data from a really wonderful study. The normal data are from this beautiful Framingham study, the town of Framingham, Massachusetts, where back in the 1940s, investigators from largely from Yale, actually, if I recall correctly, Yale and Harvard, decided to basically do a really good study. They basically took every single person in this trial, in this town, asked them a bunch of questions, measured a bunch of things, and then just followed them. It's now going on 40 years or so, 50 years, 60 years. And a lot of our information on the natural history of a lot of diseases comes from this study. And this shows in that population that as you increase your follow-up, as people get older, the incidence of cardiovascular disease increases in men significantly, you know, from about 5% with short follow-up to over 20% with 20 years of follow-up. It also increases with follow-up in age in women, but you can see that women have a lower risk of heart disease than men, even with the same follow-up. And then from the Joslin Clinic data, the same follow-up in diabetics, and you can see that in the diabetic population within this town, a dramatically increased risk of cardiovascular disease. So about a doubling of the risk, 20% to about 50, two-fold risk in men. In women, even a greater increase, about a 5-fold increase here. So you can see that normal population, after a couple of decades of follow-up, women have about half the risk of heart disease as do men. That's if you don't have diabetes. If you have diabetes, you've got the same risk. Very, very potent risk factor for heart disease. Okay. It makes sense that if high blood sugar chronically causes all of these problems, that if you treat diabetics to keep their blood sugar as close to normal as possible, you should prevent a lot of these complications. It makes a lot of sense. Trust me on this. Back when I was a fellow, endocrine fellow, there was controversy among endocrinologists because there was no data that actually proved this. Some people were more worried that if you try to control people tightly, you'll cause more problems by low blood sugar, hypoglycemia, maybe increase the risk of heart attacks and strokes because blood sugar is down, you know, going into a coma, having a car crash, whatever, and you wouldn't have any real benefit. Until two big studies were done, first in type 1 diabetics in the 1980s, the DCCT trial, conventional control, tight blood sugar control, after 10 years, highly significant decrease in type 1 diabetics in microvascular complications, macrovascular complications, eye disease, kidney disease, neuropathy. Yes, an increase in hypoglycemia events, but not in bad hypoglycemia. No question about it. Tighter control improves things. You would think logically, okay, well, it's caused by high blood sugar. Type 1 diabetics and type 2 diabetics both have high blood sugar. If it works in type 1 diabetics, it should also be in type 2 diabetics. Didn't work that way. Physicians want to see data. They were, oh, the type 2 diabetics tend to be older. They're even more at risk if you cause hypoglycemia. So in the late 1990s, the United Kingdom Prevention of Diabetes Study came out, enrolled about 4,000 newly diagnosed patients with type 2 diabetes, just like the DCCT trial, randomized them to conventional control with sulfonylureas and insulin or intensive control. Let me point out how piss poor conventional control was. Normal fasting blood sugar, this is how afraid people were just before the turn of the millennium, okay, in causing hypoglycemia and really getting normal blood sugar in diabetics. Everybody in this room has a fasting blood sugar between about 50 and 98, okay, less than 100, that's normal. Conventional control was keeping their fasting blood sugar less than 270, okay? So conventional control meant that these patients on conventional treatment with oral drugs and insulin, their blood sugar was so high that, one, it was causing damage, and two, they were spilling sugar in their urine. Renal threshold is about 200 in most people. Or intensive therapy, where the goal, they didn't reach this, but the goal was to get them down to an almost normal fasting blood sugar by giving higher doses of the oral agents and higher doses and more frequent injections of insulin. By the end of 10 years, they didn't reach that goal, but there was a big improvement. I told you that a normal hemoglobin A1C, glycosylated hemoglobin, is anything less than 6, although most of you guys are probably less than 5.5%. Conventional control was just under 8%, and they got the tight control people down to not normal, not under 6, but better, 11% lower, down to 7%, okay? And this, in type 2 diabetics, led to significant decreases in any diabetes-related problem, big one in microvascular problems, retinopathy, kidney problems, cataract extraction. Some publications will say no significant decrease in heart disease. That's a very short-sighted view because every endpoint was going in the same direction, and consistency of response is much more meaningful than reaching a magic p-value. If you doubled the number of patients in the study, this would be a p-value of less than 0.001. So a believable decrease, 16% in heart attacks, and a numerical but not significant decrease in strokes. So high blood sugar, bad. If you've got diabetes, the more normal you can be, you can really prevent getting, lower your risk of diabetes. Okay, a little bit about how our body controls blood sugar. Maintaining a normal plasma glucose is really, really important because that is the fuel for a couple of key organs, most notably the brain. Okay? First thing you're going to notice, if you took a sulfonylurea or somebody gave you insulin when you didn't need it, blood sugar would plummet. You would first get a little bit woozy. You get a headache. Your body would try to respond by pumping out adrenaline, so you'd start sweating. Your heart would be racing. As your blood sugar stays down and goes lower, you would become drowsy, and you would go into a coma. And if it stayed down long enough without somebody giving you something to bring you back, like IV glucose, you would die. Okay? So, in order to maintain glucose, during the day, it's pretty easy. You're eating. Sugar's coming in. But what is going to be keeping your blood sugar up to supply your brain and other organs for the 12 hours of the day that you're not eating? From, well, I would say normal. In my patients, it's from dinner one night to breakfast the next morning. With you guys, it's probably from midnight one night to breakfast the next morning you're not eating. Okay? What happens is that glucose is stored in the form of glycogen in the liver. And as your blood sugar goes down overnight, the alpha islets in the pancreas, since the blood sugar is low, secrete glucagon. Glucagon causes the liver to release more glucose. So glucose is coming out of the liver into the extracellular fluid, the blood, It's going then into a number of key organs that do not require insulin to take up glucose, mostly the brain, also the kidney and the red cells. And also, most glucose is taken up, because there's a lot more of this tissue than this tissue, into a bunch of organs that do require insulin to take up glucose. And that's where it's coming out of the pancreas. And that's mostly muscle and fat cells. Okay? So, as blood sugar goes up from the liver, it's going two places. It's going out of the blood into tissues that don't require insulin. High blood sugar stimulates the beta islets of the pancreas to make more insulin, and that shuttles the blood sugar into the organs that require insulin to take it up. Okay? And that's basically what's going on. It turns out that the islets make more than just insulin from the beta cells and glucagon from the islet cells. They also make some other things called, for example, amylin peptide, which is a non-glucose insulin secretagogue, which also stimulates glucose-sensitive insulin release. And diabetics are missing this peptide as well, which has now formed the basis for some new therapies. So, just some data here showing that things work like they're supposed to. You've got an isolated rat pancreas here. You can expose it to high glucose or to pretty low glucose. This is the insulin level. In high glucose, it's making a lot of insulin to bring sugar down. Sugar goes down, insulin levels drop because it's a feedback loop. Then when you bring sugar back up from a low level to a high level, what you see is the typical response in a normal person to a meal. You see two phases of insulin release. You see this rapid first phase of release, which is really what helps you respond to control the blood sugar increase right when you start eating. And then you see the slower second phase of insulin release. And normal people have both of these. As somebody develops insulin resistance, the first thing they lose is this first phase of insulin release. And that's part of the reason why, even though as somebody is developing type 2 diabetes, remember they got high insulin levels to overcome their insulin resistance, they're protecting their fasting blood sugar for a pretty long time. What goes first is the postprandial blood sugar. They get an increase in blood sugar after they eat that's abnormal. And that's because they've lost this first phase of insulin release. That results in a very different pattern of blood sugar in an early stage type 2 diabetic compared to a normal. Anybody in this room, you got a normal fasting blood sugar. It will go up after you have breakfast, but it rapidly, because of the first phase and second phase insulin release, which is really homeostatically tuned to control your blood sugar, it brings it right back down, okay, for most of you, within an hour, back to where you started from. And it stays there to lunch, goes up after lunch, will come back down, go up, not shown here, after dinner, come back down. Type 2 diabetic, early stage, very high insulin levels, but also very high glucose levels. Remember, normal is down here. Also, a greater increase after a meal than in the normal situation. Not coming back down to normal 1 hour after, but taking much longer, okay, to come back down to normal. So greater postprandial excursions and starting from a higher baseline. We're now going to go into a little bit on the pathophysiology of type 2 diabetes, which I told you is caused by insulin resistance. These are data that also come from largely that really big UK study, the UK PDS study, that really showed us that tight control benefited type 2 diabetics. Because it followed newly diagnosed folks, it also taught us a lot about the natural history of the disease. You got three curves on this slide. The yellow line is your degree of insulin resistance. Down here is normal insulin sensitivity. This is now low insulin sensitivity, insulin resistance. This dark line here is your insulin levels. And the dashed line is your blood glucose. What happens as people gain weight and they're putting fat where it doesn't belong, liver and the muscle, and you're pumping out these free fatty acids and these inflammatory cytokines, which are going out to all the tissues and causing insulin resistance, is the tissues become insulin resistant. And initially, as I mentioned, because the insulin is not working as well, it takes more insulin, the pancreas puts out more insulin. And initially, because of a higher insulin level, it keeps your glucose normal. With time, though, a little bit because it's working overtime to make insulin, and mostly because this constant exposure to these damaging free fatty acids and inflammatory cytokines, the islets will fail. And when the islets can no longer keep up, as this line diverges from this line, blood sugar starts going up. So this is pre-diabetes here. High insulin resistance. When your blood sugar, when the islets can't keep up enough So even though you've got way elevated insulin here, it isn't good enough to keep your blood sugar normal. When it gets to 126 mg per deciliter, you're diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. A couple of key points from the UK PDS study. One, the cause of this disease, the epidemic form of diabetes, is insulin resistance. And on average, by the time a patient is diagnosed with the earliest stage of type 2 diabetes, just a barely elevated fasting glucose, on average they've had the underlying cause of the disease, the insulin resistance, for 10 to 15 years. Okay? Lots of opportunity to, if you're diagnosed, to do something to prevent going on to type 2 diabetes. The second thing, which is kind of scary, but it explains why this happened, in this study, from the time of diagnosis, even though these patients, again, this is not type 1 diabetes, these patients have insulin resistance and elevated insulin levels, right? So the way to treat them, diet, weight loss, which most people can't do effectively, but drugs that actually make the insulin work better or put out more insulin, oral agents. Within 3 years of diagnosis, most of these patients no longer respond and require insulin injections, and that's because the islets eventually will fail. And they go from having high insulin to having low insulin. And it's not surprising now because they've been exposed to all these damaging free fatty acids and inflammatory cytokines for an average 18 years. So that's why that happens. So that's where insulin is started, right there. Okay, so just some data showing that insulin resistance is related to obesity. This is a large study. This is body mass index. Most of you probably know what your BMI is. It's your kind of your weight in kilograms divided by your height in meters squared. And as you increase your BMI, heavier people tend to have higher body mass indexes, you can see that your insulin sensitivity goes down. A slender person, this is a very, very lean person, normal is basically about 18 to 25 at the highest maybe. Higher insulin sensitivity, and as BMI increases, very monotonically insulin sensitivity decreases. But I told you, it's not really just total weight. It's really the amount of fat in your organs. And this study uses MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, very accurate way to ask how much fat is in your organs, like your liver and your muscle. This is the relationship between insulin sensitivity along the y-axis versus the amount of visceral fat along the x-axis. This dark line is the normal curve. I didn't make this slide, so this is confusing symbols. This is diabetics here. These are non-diabetic normals here. A couple of interesting take-home messages. One is, as you can see, in all cases, as visceral fat increases, insulin sensitivity decreases. What's interesting and a little bit perturbing is the slope of the line is a lot steeper for normal people than it is for people who already have type 2 diabetes. What this means is, if you're normal, everybody in this room, you gain a little bit of weight, you put more fat where it doesn't belong in your liver, and a smaller change in your visceral fat is associated with a much greater decrease in your insulin sensitivity than it would be in a type 2 diabetic. So a little bit of fat really goes a long way. Okay, as I mentioned, we now know a lot more about the etiology of this disease than we did even 15 years ago. Yes, it's obesity, but it's really visceral fat, and what that results in is an increase in circulating free fatty acids, the metabolites of which many of them are toxic to cells, and also it stimulates an inflammatory infiltrate, macrophages, to move in largely into the visceral fat compartment. And these macrophages do what macrophages do. These are immune cells, and they pump out all these inflammatory cytokines. And it's really the combination of this increased production of free fatty acids and this increased production of inflammatory cytokines, which goes to all of the insulin-sensitive tissues, damages them, and causes the insulin resistance, which is the ultimate cause of the disease. Okay, this brings us now to how we treat type 2 diabetes. Let me say a couple things on the slide. The mainstay of treatment for the last 65 years has been sulfonylurea. Sulfonylureas are drugs that were not rationally developed. These were chemicals back in the late 1940s, early 50s, that investigators, you know, in drug companies took off the shelf and they exposed animals and they saw that it lowered blood sugar. Okay, gave the desired effect, it lowered blood sugar. Unfortunately, sulfonylureas cause the islet to produce more insulin irrespective of your blood sugar. So it's non-glucose dependent insulin release. That's a problem for a couple of reasons. What this means is that if I gave a sulfonylurea to a diabetic with a high blood sugar, they'll put out more insulin, and despite being insulin resistant, their blood sugar will go down. That's a good thing. If I gave a sulfonylurea to any of you with normal blood sugar, your blood sugar would also go down, causing hypoglycemia. So sulfonylureas have a problem with hypoglycemia because they'll have the same effect no matter where your blood sugar is. The biggest problem that I and people at my level of endocrinology have with sulfonylureas, and even though if you go to a general practitioner 10 miles from here, probably most of his or her patients are taking a sulfonylurea because they've been used for 6 decades. Okay, a lot is known about them. They're dirt cheap because they're generic. I will not prescribe a sulfonylurea to any of my patients because I've already told you on a previous slide that the natural history of type 2 diabetes is it's caused by insulin resistance. You start with high insulin levels, okay? It damages the islet, and over time, the islet fails. Well, not surprisingly, when you give a drug that is going to beat an already flogged islet cell, in really good studies, including the UKPDS, if you compare the natural history of the progression of islet failure on diabetics not treated with SUs versus those treated with sulfonylureas, sulfonylureas increase the rapidity of islet failure. They speed up the demise of the beta islets. The last thing I would want to do in a patient with type 2 diabetes. So I don't use those compounds. Luckily, there's other compounds. There's compounds which are proven to not damage islet health, but actually improve beta islet health. Okay? Some of these, the insulin sensitizers, TZDs, drugs like Actos and Avandia, which have their own side effects, of course, these drugs improve your insulin sensitivity, decrease insulin resistance every place, liver, fat, and muscle. Okay? As a result, in both animal studies and 3 very large controlled clinical trials, indisputably proven to improve islet health, to prevent the development of diabetes in animal models, and to prevent the development of type 2 diabetes in humans at high risk of developing type 2 diabetes. That's the good news there. I use these drugs in my patients. I mentioned this other compound that comes from the pancreas, amylin, which is responsible for first phase insulin release. Well, there's 2 drugs that work kind of in the system. A compound made in your intestinal tract called glucagon-like peptide 1, GLP-1, acts like amylin and goes to the pancreas and stimulates, not like these guys, glucose-independent insulin release, but glucose-dependent insulin release. So GLP-1 or GLP-1 analogs or drugs that break down the metabolism, decrease the metabolism of normal GLP-1 and thereby raise GLP-1 levels, these restore first phase insulin release and will produce more insulin when your blood sugar is high and you need it and not when your blood sugar is low. These also seem to improve islet health, not quite as much as these guys, but still somewhat, and a lot better than these guys. Metformin is a drug that almost all type 2 diabetics are on. It's been used in the U.S. since 1996. It's been used in Europe for 20 years further than that. It's a drug that should have been approved here earlier. This is a insulin sensitizer specifically in the liver. Okay, so it's a very, very useful drug because I told you that sugar comes out of your liver at night. Okay, you would think that in diabetes, when your blood sugar is high, the liver would make less glucose at night. Paradoxically, because you've got insulin resistance here too, so even with high insulin level, the feedback loop is reduced here. In diabetics and pre-diabetics, the liver is putting out extra glucose at night. That's why fasting blood sugar goes up in type 2 diabetes. Even though they have high blood sugar they went to bed with, their liver is pumping out more glucose at night. Metformin specifically targets that and reduces hepatic glucose output. That's a good drug. We also have a few drugs which are not really a mainstay of therapy but are useful add-ons which decrease how much carbohydrate you absorb from your gut. And, of course, eventually with islet failure, you can give patients insulin. So the last slide, and I think we're pretty much on time here. What I want to leave you with is that type 2 diabetes is really scary for 2 main reasons. One is it's affecting a huge number of patients. Could I have a show of hands? Don't be shy. How many of you have a relative, parent, grandparent, aunt, or uncle that has diabetes? Anybody? Yeah. That's in an older cohort where the risk of getting diabetes was a whole lot lower than it is now. What the data says in people in your cohort of age, four times that risk of developing diabetes. So it's really, really common, and it's really common for three major reasons. For most of recorded human history, okay, from pre-Cro-Magnon to Cro-Magnon and Homo sapiens sapien, except for the last basically 100 years, it was really hard getting energy-dense food. Okay, for most of recorded human history, most of sustenance was not things that contained fat, which is 9 calories per gram, okay, but it was, you know, seeds and nuts and berries and various things they found. Carbohydrate, 4 calories per gram. If you're lucky enough to find some protein, 4 calories per gram. Most energy-dense form of a food is fat, 9 calories per gram. That's why, for most recorded human history, every once in a great while when they brought down a mastodon or a bear or some other animal, the organ meat highest in fat and the fat itself, highly prized, went to the people highest in the hierarchy, because that's what it took to survive the periods of famine, was having high body fat. Nowadays, it is really, really easy finding high energy-dense foods. It's exactly what you don't want. People that have money, okay, can buy healthier foods. But the cheapest foods that are available to people with the lowest income are the worst foods. Okay, so in populations with low income, the food that is easiest to get because it is the cheapest, dollars per calorie, are foods that are very high in fat. So we've come from a period for 99.9% of human history where fat was very hard to find and was prized, to actually where it's very easy to get. At the same time, we are expending a lot less energy than our parents and certainly our grandparents and great-grandparents did. So for most of human history, most of your time was working hard trying to find food and doing, you know, work out in the field someplace. Nowadays, there have been huge demographic shifts. What happened in the U.S. in the early part of this century has happened in China and India. During the latter part of the last century, shifts from rural villages to the cities, much more sedentary jobs. So at the same time that our energy intake is going way up, our energy expenditure is going way down. In the ideal situation, okay, that would result in packing on more weight, which is fat, and the fat's going to be in your organs. That's why it's going up. But it's worse than that. Because most of our history, it was really hard to find fat, there's been a selective advantage for people that have thrifty genes. Okay? The people that survived better, that lived long enough to early adulthood and were able to have kids, were the people that actually were better able to take calories when they were available and store it as fat. They could survive the famine that happened every single year, okay, when you couldn't get food. People that were what's a good phenotype now, which is to be very energy inefficient, to burn up most of your calories. The people that are really skinny, no matter what they eat, that's great now, it's very healthy. But for most of recorded human history, those people often didn't live to adulthood because they would die during the winter. So there's been a huge selective advantage to pack on fat. It's disastrous in a situation where fat is really easy to get. That's why we have an epidemic of obesity. That's why we have an epidemic of type 2 diabetes. Next take-home message is diabetes is a really horrible disease. I've told you. Number one cause of blindness, number one cause of amputations, number one cause of kidney failure, 3 to 5-fold increase in the risk of heart attack, which is the number one way you're going to die anyway. Increase that 5-fold and dramatically shortens lifespan. A really good disease to avoid. The good news is it is possible to avoid this. Even if the deck is stacked against you, even if you've got two parents with type 2 diabetes, okay, where your risk of getting diabetes is markedly increased, if you maintain a lean body type, if you eat healthy, okay, avoid high-fat foods, and in particular stay active, you can markedly reduce your risk of getting insulin resistance and type 2 diabetes. And I'll leave with one thing, somewhat counterintuitively, but good studies have documented this. Activity, exercise on a regular basis is actually, not only is it good for cardiovascular health, it's more important in preventing insulin resistance, type 2 diabetes, than is body weight. So if you compare in a study patients with prediabetes, okay, and you put them on an isocaloric diet, but they increase their exercise and their weight doesn't change, or you put them on a diet where they lose weight, you get greater improvements, normalization of their metabolic pattern, greater decreases in insulin, greater improvements, decreases in free fatty acids in the exercising group that maintained their weight than in the dieting group. So the combination is good. You want to increase your energy and eat less calories to lose weight. But actually, the exercise is even a little bit more important. So with that, I'm really happy to take any questions you have, and thank you for your attention. Please.
If you just drink like a couple cans of soda a day, but you're not like really obese or gaining a lot of weight, is that going to increase your risk of getting diabetes?
Yeah. Here's the sitch. You know, a little bit of calories go a long way. You're about how tall?
5'10".
5'10". So probably, I could do the calculation, but ballpark, you probably need something along 2,500 kilocalories to maintain your weight. Okay? If you're burning up this many calories a day, and you're taking this amount, you're going to maintain your weight. Okay? Let's talk about 2 cans of soda. Okay? Can of soda, non-diet, is about, 150 calories? 200 calories? I think. It's about 10% sugar. It's 16 ounces. So yeah, call it 200 calories, okay? So 2 cans is 400 calories. Okay then. You have 2 of these extra a day on top of your diet. What we have is an extra 400 calories a day, 2 cans of soda, times 30 days in a month. So each month, that's in excess of 12,000 calories. Okay? Fat is 9 calories per gram. Okay? Therefore, 9,000 calories equals 1 pound of fat. So this is 1.25 pounds of fat per month that you're putting on by adding to your regular diet 2 cans of soda a day. So if we go 1.25 times 12 over a year, that's 15 pounds of fat. Okay? You've heard of the freshman 15? That's where it comes from. And here's the problem. Okay? Real big difference between apples and pears. So-called female fat distribution. We're carrying it here. That's normal, small adipocyte, subcutaneous fat. Not a problem. Non-inflammatory, doesn't cause a problem. Fat here, increased waist size, fat in your organs, that's where you're putting on the extra weight. That's what causes type 2 diabetes. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Let's give it up.